This is the In Search More podcast, and I will see you on the other side.
Good afternoon, Rip Chase.
Hi, Tungurab Ali.
All right, a very spontaneous podcast recording,
Yeah.
Just a recording.
Tomorrow night is Yom Kippur.
So we're here, October 3rd, 2022. Tishrei, whatever year it is. It's a new year. I forget.
Hey, Gimel.
Okay.
5783.
So as it happens, by sheer coincidence, so I release on my podcast, I do two brief episodes a week. But I record maybe 10 or 15 at once, and different ones get released. As it happens, by sheer coincidence, this morning, one got released on forgiveness. So it wasn't timed with Yom Kippur. The person who runs it is not Jewish. It was timed by someone other than him. An episode on forgiveness. So I shared that episode with you, a 5-minute episode on what we can and can't forgive for. And as the conversation ensued, I thought it would be beneficial to many people to hear some of your thoughts, my questions. So why don't we? So we got on here.
Out of Tanya class. I have a Tanya class, 11 a.m. on Central Avenue in Cedarhurst on Mondays. So I was walking out of Tanya class. I saw a text from you. And you're saying, what do you think about this? So as I was walking home, I listened to your thing about forgiveness. I was like, it's a fresh take. Never heard that. I mean, exactly. I never heard exactly those words. In fact, I think I even asked you, I said, is this your chiddush? Meaning, is this your novel, innovative take on it? Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll share what I said over there.
Catch everyone
up. A little bit. Not assuming everyone is listening. And we'll go from there. And even if they listened, maybe they forgot. So what I'd spoken about was, then perhaps, I don't know if I suggested as a perhaps, but my thought was, and something I've shared with others, is that in the same way that it's impossible for us to forgive a sin or a wrong perpetrated on another human being, it would be impossible for us to forgive something done to ourselves as children. Because it's very easy for me as a 37-year-old man to forgive what was done to me as a 6-7-year-old child. I'm no longer in that situation. So the same way we can't forgive for another person, we can't forgive for another person within ourselves, the 7, 6, 5-year-old child that is. Right.
You're saying like if I wrong you and I go to your friend and I say, could you forgive me for what I did to Ellie?
Preposterous.
I don't know. Go to Ellie. You talk to him. Sure. Right. Right. So you're suggesting that by the time a person is an adult, he and his child self are so sufficiently different that for the person himself as an adult to try to forgive those who did wrong against himself as a child would be akin to forgiving someone for something they did to a completely different person, which we all know wouldn't work.
Right. When I first had this idea,
meaning who are you to forgive it? It wasn't
exactly
done to you.
It wasn't done to you.
Yeah. Right.
When I first had this thought, it was, I was saying it as it's the wrong thing to do. But as I processed it, as I articulated it, I said, no, not that it's the wrong thing to do. It's meaningless. It's not something that could be done. So we have to go about it in a different way. And in the episode, what I communicated there was we have to validate, we have to advocate, we have, you know, for the child in that scenario. That's the only thing we could do so that the child no longer has that hurt. But if we sit there
and
say,
you gave a very like, sort of startling and very vivid description the 5-minute clip I heard where you described it as a courtroom.
Correct. So it would be, imagine I walked into a courtroom and let's say the adult who wronged me on the other side is a teacher of mine. So I, as an adult, I'm walking into a courtroom and on one side is a 6-year-old, my 6-year-old, me as a 6-year-old, you know, and on the other side, I am the plaintiff. The 6-year-old is the plaintiff, I should say. I am me walking into the courtroom. On the other side of the courtroom is this adult teacher.
The defendant.
And the 6-year-old child is saying, you embarrassed me in front of the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you know, this is what you did to me then. And this is what still lingers with me until this day. And as an adult, I'm walking into that And I can do one of two things, and obviously one of three. I cannot walk into the courtroom, obviously. But once I walk in, I can take one side or the other. And very often as adults, what we move towards is excuses or justifications for the defendant. And we say things like, he was doing his best, or do you know what he went through at the time? And my suggestion was, more than a suggestion, my recommendation for someone who wants to heal, so it's more of a direction for someone who wants to take on that path, is to stand squarely in defense and advocate for his own child and say, no, this is what you did wrong, and this is how it affected, and this is, you know, all of those things.
I love the description, but just to give pushback, because I think that
I like pushback. You don't have to.
Yeah, I think it'll just make it even more compelling. The adult's tendency to want to find some type of exonerating argument on behalf of this accused or defendant, correct, right, is actually coming from a very mature place. It's coming from the perspective that an adult has, and perhaps that the adult only gained from having gone through this hardship. And it's actually a very enlightened view of being able to see the other side and find mitigating arguments. And it's a sign of maturity.
Yeah, I would say, you know, on certainly for the child, for the two in the courtroom, they both want to get past it. That's 100% their motivation, right? They're on the same page. Sometimes as adults, we have reasons that we want to hold on to hurts. But those two in the courtroom, the plaintiff and the defendant, I would say both have the same goal, right? They're not here in their ego form, right? They're both.
Which adult are you talking about? The defendant, I thought, was the.
The defendant was the teacher.
Wrong. Right.
Correct. As an adult, right? The teacher as an adult.
So right. And the defendant is not really in this room. This is a completely internal process.
Correct.
Right?
100%.
We're not talking about confronting anybody here. No, We're talking about in a totally internal state in your mind, how you choose to regard this person's role in your life.
Yeah, what happens very often is when we're going through our childhood experiences, we immediately go to defending and advocating for the person who wronged us.
Right.
And what I was suggesting, with the goal of eventually getting over it, right? Not to...
Which you're saying is a good goal. Wanting to get over it is a good goal.
Right. That's what I was saying, is that no one has
bad intentions. And I'm saying even more than that the tools that the adult uniquely has to enable them to get over it are actually very healthy tools and a sign of growth.
Correct.
The only problem is
that it doesn't work because it can't be done.
And your argument And your argument is, which I think is a very interesting way of, because without this whole description, without this whole scenario, it's very difficult to understand what you're saying. Well, why wouldn't it work? It sounds, you know, you're choosing to let go of the hurt. You're choosing to move on. Why shouldn't it work? But when you describe it as two different parties, your adult self and your child self, well, that's why it doesn't work, because you're not the one who's in a position to forgive. Or maybe even tell me if you agree with this, because I'm sort of putting words in your mouth now. I can forgive the one who wronged me the way that affects me now in the present as an adult, because I am in a position to forgive that. But I can't forgive the way it affected this child, because who am I to tell the one who did wrong, it's okay what you did to somebody else?
Correct. Exactly. So what do we do instead? That's what I was suggesting there. Again, the goal is to get through it.
So we're at an impasse where the forgiveness, what you're arguing, is not only inappropriate, but it's practically speaking, it's ineffective. It won't work. It won't work.
Yes. So my worldview is that these little people still live inside us, right? These unhealed little people still live inside us. The ones that are healed, kind of, we can see the progression, 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 6, up until my age of 37, your age of 25, right? So right, we can see the progression, how they, if you want to correct anyone on the age, I know that everyone wants to look younger. So that's all I meant.
With rabbis, it's very prestigious to look sagacious and old. Yeah, 40.
All right, we have the 17-year-old rabbi who looked like he was 70. And this was
that's a right, the classic right? from the Pesach Seder. Yeah.
Okay, you look like 148.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So when it's integrated, right, everything is fine, right? We see the age and progression, but here you have a 6 or 7 year old. Complaint that has been unaddressed, so it can't completely integrate. It still sits there unhealed. That 6-year-old child, the 7-year-old, why did you embarrass me? Why did you embarrass me? And when the adult steps in, the adult of this child steps into the picture and defends and says, this was completely not okay. And what you did to him was A, B, C, D, E, F, G. So, okay, finally, I've been heard. I've been advocated for. And he could collapse into the structure of the person. That's further on that perspective, meaning this is not in any way to maintain a victim status forever. That's not the goal. Actually, I liked what you responded to me in the text. Maybe I'll talk about that. You mentioned John Bradshaw, the author of Healing the Shame That Binds Us. And something he mentioned, I don't want to put words in your mouth. So about
I didn't hear this directly from him, but he had a method, I think, that they did at the Meadows, and I heard it from someone who heard it from him, that when they do some of the exploration of childhood trauma, well, sometimes there are people who are nervous about going there because they don't want to look upon their parents with a critical eye. So his expression is that, you know, you have to arraign the defendant before you can have a trial which acquits them. So otherwise, the whole thing is just, you know, there are these accusations floating around and never kind of got clarity. But if there's a, you know, if there's an indictment and the grand jury says we're going to go to trial and you go through a trial, okay, in the end, you can acquit. But there was a trial.
Right. So, okay, that's the same idea. I think it's the same.
The goal is acquittal. The goal is to.
Right. The goal is eventual acquittal. So maybe.
Not vengeance. It's not punitive. Correct, 100%. The goal is not punitive. No.
The goal, we all want to move on, but that's the point. We can't acquit something that we've never gone through. Okay. So maybe that's a different way of saying this, the same. Maybe that's a different way of saying the same point. Let me.
And I might even add, if I were going to. Be Hasidic for a moment, but one of the things we learned it actually from Korach's attempted mutiny against Moshe Rabbeinu. So there was an attempted rebellion against the authority of Moses, and so the way that Hasidus explains it is that it strengthened the leadership of Moses, and even more so the role of Aaron as high priest. Which is interesting because Yom Kippur is tomorrow night, which is all about the high priest. But at any rate,
saying the difficulty strengthened it.
So the metaphor that it gives over there is that, and this is actually an interesting halachic tidbit if you want to know about how rabbinic courts work. A document can always be called into question. Someone brings a document to a rabbinic court. So somebody could always say, well, I don't know, maybe it's a forgery. Let's look into it.
Right.
There's only one kind of document that is considered ironclad, that once you bring it in, that's it. It's indisputable. And that is a document that was called into question previously and had been subsequently verified.
Validated.
Right. So then after
it's like
that,
double jeopardy. We can't
right. that becomes the strongest type of proof. So the idea is that calling something into question, challenging something, and allowing it to go through the process of being challenged actually strengthens it. So if I were to take this back to the whole concept of you know, you have a relationship. Let's say it's, you know, some people wronged us. We don't really have any desire to continue a relationship. Maybe even they're so far in the past, or maybe they're no longer living. Or, but sometimes, you know, there's a relationship that you want to keep, and for other reasons, the relationship has continued meaning, And the question is, well, what do you do with this elephant in the room, this wrong that this person did to you? So one inclination is, well, let's stay away from it. That's the third rail. Don't touch it. And the other is, it sounds like what you're saying is to lean into it, to go through the process, to submit to the process. And I guess what I'm adding is the idea that perhaps that process itself not only will lead to acquittal, forgiveness, but additionally, it could actually lead to a stronger relationship with that person.
Correct. Oh, I thought you were referring to a stronger relationship with oneself, that people get better from the challenges, but that wasn't the point you're making.
No, I was, well, that I'm sure that's true.
Right, you're saying eventually, right, if you go into the details of it.
I'm saying people are so afraid that if I'm going to look upon this person with a critical eye, I don't know how I'm going to pull myself back out of it. And, you know, it's too dangerous. It's too dangerous.
Right.
And I'm saying, well, perhaps it is the best path forward to actually
forge an even stronger connection.
Yeah.
Understood. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Right. I want to be clear on something, right? I'm not an advocate, and I don't think you are either, of the Freudian type of therapy, which is you're going to lie down on the couch,
get it all out,
explore your childhood,
right?
And we're going to find all the things.
Right.
But this is more of
your mother didn't toilet train you properly, and correct. Right.
Let's see what we can find.
Right.
But instead,
we'll find dirt. We can always find dirt. We're going to find your tweets from 10 years ago. Right. No.
Right. Do we look for a person to find the crime, or do we look for a crime and then find, you know, who's behind it? So, right. So we're not talking about that type of method. What we're talking about is I'm going through my life, and then there are things that I bump into. Maybe it's that I want to build a larger company and I'm struggling with something. And as I'm working with a coach, I bump into something from childhood. Or maybe it's an addiction that I'm trying to get over. And as part of trying to get over that addiction, I realize how certain childhood things are holding me back. So I want to be, we have to be clear about what we're talking about. We're not saying
we're not looking for problems.
Right. We're looking to move forward. And every once in a while, in order to move forward, we got to go.
Yeah. You know, run into this and you're like, oh, I see. Okay. This is still an issue.
So this overall concept of not being able to forgive for oneself, you're okay with. I didn't say anything sacrilegious.
No, I don't think so.
Got it. So let me share something that a process that I went through a little while ago on forgiveness. And I want to hear your thoughts on this as well. We started touching on it, and that's where we said, let's get on a call. So what was happening was I was working on forgiving a family member for something, right? And there's a reason why I specify family member is because if I was looking to forgive someone else, it's often easier to go through that process of they did A, B, and C to me and they're terrible people. And as a result, you know, I need it to be made right. Mm-hmm. And the person I was working on this recommended, Ellie, I think you should forgive this family member. Mm-hmm. And I responded back. I said, I don't know what you're telling me. That's what I've been doing forever is to say, I want to forgive. I want to move past. You know, it's like I challenged someone years ago and saying he had recommended to a child sex abuse victim to get over it. I said, mm-hmm. You're not adding anything new to this person has been trying to get over it forever. Mm-hmm. You didn't give them a new idea. You think that's what they've been trying to do for the last 25 years, but it keeps coming up. And that's why we say get through it. So mm-hmm. I responded back to this person and said, like, what do you mean forgiveness? Like, I'm still up to just trying to get in touch with what was actually done wrong. And you're saying mm-hmm. I should forgive. But they said, think about it, and walked away. So I sat on it. And the idea came to me that maybe what I need to do is forgive. But when I forgive, I should enumerate the sins. Because normally what we say is someone will call you for Yom Kippur. Elie, mechel me. I say, well, mechel for what?
For what?
Let's be specific. Let's go into it. You have a couple hours to meet. Uh-huh. I'll tell you what you did to me. So, so to enumerate the sins, and as I'm working through this, and it was,
and you're taking that from the vidui, where we literally go through an alphabetic list.
So, right,
that begadnu.
that idea came to me later because this happened about a month ago. And I'm saying, hey, you know, we're in Elul, Yom Kippur's on the horizon. What do we do, Yom Kippur, mm-hmm. to ask for our own forgiveness?
We're very specific.
Yeah. Ashamnu, Bagadnu, Gazalnu. And I don't know if this concept is anywhere, but what I thought was that when it's saying it alphabetically, it's saying we know there's more sins than the 20, or how many Hebrew letters are there? 23, 22?
22. Yeah, Chaf Beis, yeah.
We know there are more than the 22 letters, more than 22 sins or 22 types of sins. What I understood it as is Ashamnu and anything that begins with the letter Aleph. But God knew, and anything that begins with the letter Beis. That's the way I understood. So you
know,
I wrote.
It's even more than that. You know what it is? This that Tzemach Tzedek says in Derech Mitzvah Vidui Yitshuva. He says, once you have the whole Aleph Beis and you have all the letters, now you got Scrabble. Spell any sin you want.
Oh, I got it. Okay. Okay, so it's even more. Okay. So maybe I have to do it again because I didn't get through all the letters, but the idea was there. And what I did is A, you know, specifying what A was, B, specifying what B was, and everything that starts with A, everything that starts with B. I like what you had about the sound aesthetic. And from there, I can tell you for me, when I went through that process, it felt like I was able to let go of it in a different way. And so no problem, I'll forgive. No problem, I'll forgive. But I want to enumerate the sins that I'm forgiving for. Let me tell you what was done. What was done to my child. For me, I'm comfortable forgiving, but I can't forgive.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess so enumerating, maybe it's the same thing. Enumerating is the advocating.
Mm-hmm.
The enumeration of the sin is the same thing. Maybe I'm saying the same thing. Is there, so let's bring it back to the practical. If someone
and just again to reiterate, even though we've said this a few times, you are not talking about a confrontation. You're not talking about going to this person in real life and saying to them,
correct,
this, 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 and this.
I'm talking about a completely internal process where I want to get past this. Mm-hmm. My goal is to get past this forgiveness. And what I bumped into was get past the story and forgive completely. And I'm saying that no matter how many times I say it, I'm still holding on to that resentment in some way. And mm-hmm. it's still affecting me in other relationships. It's still not put to bed. That's what I'm noticing. Mm-hmm. And because it's not put to bed, I'm saying maybe there's a different way to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this other way of going about it, advocating, enumerating the sins, that's how I'm exploring this. That's how I'm arriving at this. And I can mm-hmm. say that after going through this process, I felt that something else, that something was lifted. It's hard to know. You know, if you're carrying something for a very long time, it's hard to know that you're actually carrying it.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you put half of it down, you may think you put all of it down. So I'm not saying mm-hmm. all of it is down, but it definitely feels like some of it has been put down since going through that process of enumerating it. Now, my question is this.
Yeah.
Just to bring it practical.
So everyone understands, basically, to oversimplify it, you stumbled intuitively upon a process where, just like we know we're supposed to enumerate and be as specific as possible with confessing our own wrongs, so too, perhaps it's helpful as an internal process when trying to forgive somebody to enumerate their wrongs. In other words, like you have a court case to follow along with the imagery that you were you were conjuring. You know, they read the charges to
and they say guilty, not guilty, right? Or this is the penalty. You know, guilty, but you can go home. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
It was done in a first degree premeditated way, a second degree less conscious, right? Third mm-hmm. degree, so on, but. Yes, it's enumerated and it's discussed.
Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, before you get into the next question, which I think you were going to ask me, we're talking about a situation where this is old history. I think that's important to clarify. Talking about a situation where this is old history. Well, because if this is an ongoing...
Right, you've got my next question. Go.
Perfect. Oh, that was your next question?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I thought I was squeezing this in before.
No, perfect. No, say it. Perfect.
If it's an ongoing situation where they're currently wronging you, that's a little bit different.
That was exactly my next question. Yes, can we forgive something that is ongoing? So what happens, you have Yom Kippur's Yom Kippur comes. We're supposed to forgive. We are asked to forgive. But there's a wrong that either is ongoing or we feel is ongoing. Does it even make sense to forgive for those wrongs? I'm trying to think of an example, but
yeah.
Let's say there's a business dispute.
Yeah.
Okay. Over a percentage of how much of a business is owned. And a guy feels he was wrong. 10% of this company was taken from him, let's say. And would it make any sense to forgive when it's ongoing? The day before Yom Kippur, he's losing 10%. The day after Yom Kippur, he's losing 10%. Is there any basis? Is there anything? Can one even forgive?
I mean, it's just, as it says pretty clearly, Laisisna es achicha bilvavecha. Don't hate your brother in your heart. And what does that mean? Don't hate him in your heart. So then it continues, says, but rather, haycheach teychiach es amisecha. Rebuke him, which rebuke has to be translated properly because people think it means go fight with him or go humiliate him to get revenge on how he wronged you. But it means talk it out. So something that is an ongoing situation, actually, the Torah tells us pretty clearly, don't try to just stuff it and be, you know, don't fear the confrontation. Be open about it.
Work it out. Sit down with that person.
Work it out. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And then to finish the verse, because I said the three clauses, two clauses out of the three in the verse, but the verse continues, v'laisisa olav chet, and don't bear a sin, don't carry a sin. What does that mean, don't carry a sin? So Rashi says that when you go and work it out with him, you be careful one thing, which is not to embarrass him in the course of doing it.
So the three things again. Number one. So
the first thing, laisisna es achicha bilvavecha.
Don't
carry it in your heart. Okay. By the way, again, when you were saying this is not like the Freudian psychoanalysis where we're going trying to figure out how our mother toilet trained us wrong. We're not looking for a problem. This is, the reality is I have this hurt. There is a hurt. It's not like I went and I said, oh, what could I find to be mad at Ellie about? No, there is a thing that I'm.
Well, we find I'm still carrying this
anger. Yeah, I'm still carrying it, right?
Also, I like that language. I often tell people, I don't know where I heard it from. I may have even heard it from you, that a resentment is a resentiment.
You know where I heard that from? You might have heard it from me, but I'll tell you where I heard it from.
Go ahead.
I think I heard it from Joe and Charlie on their big book study when they were doing the fourth step inventory, they did the resentments. I think they explained that over there.
Right. So resentment, meaning to feel anger, because it says laisista esachicha bavavcha. It sounds like, right, I'm carrying it in some way. Right. There's it's not like it's passing through. It's not a feeling the first time. That's
right. Exactly.
In your heart. It's hanging out.
I'm carrying it.
Right. I'm re-feeling this. I'm re-sentimenting this.
Right. So the verse continues. So rather, v'ycheach teychiach es amisecha.
Sit down and have a conversation.
Yeah, sit down and talk it out. But provided, what's the caveat? V'leisisa olav chet. Don't sin in the course of doing it, which Rashi says means don't embarrass him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so do it privately and do it respectfully.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. So that's if it's ongoing, we have pretty clear guidance.
Another question on forgiveness. Are there things we don't want to forgive for? And I understand maybe the Holocaust, right? That would be the
That's always the question. Do you forgive the Nazis? You know what my answer to that? Because I've been asked that hundreds of times.
Right. It was wrongs to many people, so we can't forgive for...
To me, it's not even the question of many people. If it was one child, it doesn't matter. It's not about quantity. It's not about how many people. My answer always is, I'm not a Holocaust survivor. I'm not in a position. Oh, this is very similar to how you started.
Right. Okay, you're forgiving for someone else. But that wasn't my question.
You're asking me? You're asking me to forgive? Thank God it didn't happen to me.
Not all of it happened to you.
And I know Holocaust survivors who did choose to forgive the Nazis. And I will not question their decision to do so because they are in a position to make that choice.
And they're not forgiving the Nazis for everyone else they hurt. Just the wrong that was
presumably
done to them.
Presumably.
Well, you can't. Right.
You can't, yeah.
So yeah. My question is...
Although, if you want to just continue this for a second, What I have, when I've been pressed about this issue, I say, listen, thank God I'm not a Holocaust survivor. I'm not the child of Holocaust survivors. I'm not even the grandchild of Holocaust survivors. My family came over here before World War I. But to the extent that my mother, who's a baby boomer, saw film in the 40s that traumatized her and made her hypervigilant, and that freaked me out and caused me issues, that I can forgive for.
You got it.
Okay, that ha'arada, ha'arada, ha'arada.
And by the way, in that way, we're probably all affected by it. For sure. You're right.
Yeah. Everyone that lives in this world probably, yeah.
My question was a little different, though, is are there types of wrongs that we should not be forgiving for? Or when we say forgiveness, we should forgive everything done to us, obviously. Meaning the Holocaust example wasn't an example of forgiving something done to someone else. The Holocaust example was something so big. Would we say, okay, the really big stuff, we understand why you don't forgive. Maybe we.
But again, I don't think it's a question of big or small. I think it's a question of are you in a position to forgive for that? If it didn't happen to you, who are you to forgive for it?
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying something that happened to me very big. Should I forgive, or are there certain big things that I should never forgive?
That's what I'm saying to you. Just like I rejected big the notion.
I'm saying big to me.
But just like I rejected the notion that the Holocaust is unforgivable because of its scale. And I said, no, actually, it's unforgivable because who are you? You're not in a position to forgive. I would say the exact same thing regarding things where I am in a position to forgive, that it really is not relevant what the scale of the wrong done is. The example that, I mean, if you want to get really gruesome here, the example that our sages give is filokateia es yade. Even if somebody cuts off your hand, hands don't grow back, you know?
Right.
So that's the gruesome example that the sages use to illustrate the Torah's expectation. Or at least ideal, maybe I won't say expectation, but ideal of forgiveness. That you should somehow find it in your heart.
Right, interesting. And would you make a distinction between that kind of ongoing, right? Someone losing their arm and it not being able to grow back, that's one kind of ongoing. And someone continuously stealing, you know, 10% of someone's company.
Right. Fooled me once, shame on you. Fooled me twice, shame on me. Right.
It's ongoing in a different way. It's not the damage that's ongoing. It's the offense that's ongoing.
Right. Yeah. But that's what I'm saying. It's like there are repercussions that are lifelong. So he cut off the hand once and the hand continues to be lacking forever. But then there are ongoing offenses where, you know, you wronged me on Sunday, and then you wronged me on Monday, and then you wronged me on Tuesday, and then you wronged me on Wednesday.
So that you go back to Eichech, Tichir, sit down and have a conversation.
Yeah, and that's why I said, fooled me once, shame on you. Fooled me twice, shame on me. At some point, I have to ask, why am I such a codependent that I let this guy hurt me 10 times? Or whatever number you want to assign to it. After 100 times, why are you continuing to put yourself in a position? Now, if you're talking about a child who's dependent on caregivers and it's their caregivers who have wronged them 100 times, 1,000 times, 10,000 times, the answer there is very clear. The child's not in a position to extract himself from the situation. So then it's not a question of being a codependent. It's just they have no way out. But I'm talking about an adult where there's someone who wrongs you repeatedly. At some point, you have to ask yourself the question, why are you in a position to be wronged by the same person in the same way so many times?
Right. You may need to ask forgiveness from yourself, not the other person.
Yeah, the wrong that I did to myself by being obsessed with showing up in a dangerous place.
Right.
Yeah. And again, I want to just be very, every time we're talking about these sensitive issues, I want to state the obvious, because sometimes when things are so emotional, the obvious ceases to be obvious. Even if I'm an idiot and a codependent for putting myself into a situation to be wrong by someone 100 times, it doesn't exonerate them for wronging me each one of those 100 times. We're not talking about whether or not that person is accountable person's still accountable for the wrong that they did to me. But that's really neither here nor there as far as my spiritual growth. What I need to figure out is, why was I available 100 times for that same abuse?
Right. Right. Meaning the abuser doesn't get to make that argument.
Correct. Right. That's none of their business. That's between me and my higher power and whoever else I feel I need on my staff to get insight on this.
Okay. So over here, we mostly dealt with sins that are between man and man. And we've also, you know, there's the sins between man and God. But before I even go to that distinction, when someone asks me for forgiveness, or I ask someone else for forgiveness, is there a responsibility on the other party? I always heard this as a child, that once they ask for forgiveness three times, then it's on the other person if they say no.
Yeah, that's a real thing. I mean, the Rambam speaks about it in Hilchos Tshuva. It's a real thing.
Okay, so let's go into that. Does the Rambam specify that point of enumeration? Because I understand that if someone asked three times with genuine contrition and enumeration and something else, actually, mm-hmm. let's go into this, because you and I have had many conversations about the 12 steps.
Mm-hmm.
In the 12 steps, apologies and forgiveness are fairly meaningless without amends. Amends meaning making it right. It would be totally meaningless to call someone and say, I'm sorry, I stole $10 from you.
Right.
Without also saying, here's my plan to give it back. There's no.
Right. And I think this is very important, that in halacha, the wrongs that are between two people, you cannot ask for what we call mechila, for forgiveness, until restitution has been made.
So let's go on to this, because I gave a money example, which actually is not appropriate because it's very obvious how to make restitution. So let me talk about how the 12 steps, how I learned from the 12 steps, how to deal with this, and tell me what you think and how it applies here, maybe what the Rambam is saying. When someone, right, sorry is a four-letter word in the 12 steps,
okay. Right?
It's to say, I'm sorry to someone, your sponsor will kick you in the pants. We don't do sorry, we do amends. So you call
because there's something self-serving about the apology, because and by the way, you see this a lot. I want to be careful here, but you see this a lot in the mechila frenzy that happens in some communities before Yom Kippur. Hold on a second. When you come to me to make amends, are you trying to take something from me, or are you trying to give something to me? You understand? When somebody comes to me and they're asking forgiveness for their peace of mind, they're taking from me. Now they've taken from me twice. They wronged me somehow. And now, because their guilty conscience doesn't let them enter Yom Kippur without coming to settle the debt, they have to come to me to make sure they get my mechila. They're trying to take it from me. And now they're doing something selfish, as opposed to someone who's coming to me to placate me because they don't want me to carry that burden of the wrong that was done to me. So to me, it's a very simple, standard. Is it an act of giving or is it an act of taking? So we were saying before, you know, doing like ninth step amends in the 12 step program, why a sponsor would kick you in the pants for saying, I'm going to go tell people I'm sorry. It's like, well, why? Because you're trying to relieve your guilty conscience. No, it's not about getting their forgiveness. It's about you have something of theirs, whatever it is that you took, whether materially or if you took their peace of mind emotionally, and you're trying the best you can, even though it's intangible, to restore that to some extent. So then you're giving. So that's an act of giving.
Right. And what I was taught was that when it is not something tangible, then you ask the question at the end. And the question is, how do I make this right? And then you wait for the response. Mm-hmm. And the response has no expectations. In the case of trying to restore a relationship, maybe where communication was cut off, or in the case where something was done wrong of an intangible nature, you just see, maybe the answer is you can't make it right. But we have that aspect to it. When the Rambam says this about asking for forgiveness three times, is what you're saying, are these components of it? What you're talking about, the giving versus getting?
Well, I think it's implied. Again, it's Ram Hilchas Tshuva, and he explains the process. First of all, he says you have to make restitution. Like, don't go and ask for mechila. Don't ask for forgiveness until you've made restitution. But
so what is restitution where it's not tangible?
Okay, so when it's not tangible, then there's another aspect of it. There's only the other aspect of it.
Living amends.
What I guess sometimes we call it living amends. The Rambam calls it, he says that if you've wronged them, so what you have to do is first you have to give them back the thing. You got to give him whatever you owe him. Yeah, okay, if that's applicable. But here's the bigger thing. You have to appease him, I think I would translate it. And then you ask him to forgive you. So if there's nothing tangible, so you just skip to the part to appease him. But he's very clear there that it's not just a technical thing of like, okay, so how much did I steal from you? Okay, $100. Here's $100. Okay, now we're even. He explains that there's an emotional component where, I mean, does the Rambam then explain what does it mean that the person feels better at the end of the process? I think you need some emotional intelligence to figure that out. And if you can't figure it out on your own,
right, so it's not what you're saying is it's pretty clear that the Rambam is not advising that we call a friend and we say before Yom Kippur, will you forgive me? Will you forgive me? Will you forgive me? And then at that point in time, it's on them.
Okay, that should be abundantly obvious.
It's not, yes, listen,
I know you agree, but it's an attempt to make it right. So an attempt to make it right has usually two aspects. First of all, was there a tangible loss? If yes, that must be reinstated before anything else can be discussed. Okay, even if that has been reinstated, remuneration, compensation, whatever it is, okay, now we get to the leratzoisai. You have to emotionally make them whole to the best of your ability. And if there was nothing material, so then you go straight to that. So asking for forgiveness is not like a perfunctory type of, it's not a game. It's an attempt to emotionally make someone feel that there's some type of justice.
Okay.
I think
obvious,
a lot of times the people think that the appeasement is about me. If I go to you and I'm trying to appease you, that the more contrition I show, the better of a asking for forgiveness that I've done. And that's not necessarily the case at all. In fact, in many, many cases, the dramatic display of contrition on the part of the offender, the abuser, is indulgent and is a second form of abuse. Not only do you have to endure whatever I did to you, but now I'm going to make you watch how guilty I feel, so I can, you know, I can do my Shakespearean, my theatrical display, my crocodile tears, and which again is indulgent and a form of taking.
Right, so it's a double abuse.
It's a double abuse. It compounds the abuse.
Yeah, a friend of mine once told me that their father would beat them, and then the mother would tell them that after he did that to you, he went and cried, which is a kind of a double.
Right.
So now feel bad that you were beat, and feel bad that your father's crying.
Right, which may even hurt even more in some ways.
Right, that's what you're talking about. That over there, it's a double. Right.
So what I want to make clear is the emotional component of asking forgiveness is not how well can I display my guilt to you. No, it has nothing to do with my feelings. It has to do with your feelings. It's how well can I reinstate your feeling of pain or wrong, of injustice that you experienced at my hands. How well can I reinstate that?
I'll share a story to explain this. So I've been in recovery, you know, started maybe 8 years ago. And during that time, I did the 12 steps with three different sponsors. And there was one person who came up the first time I went through the 12 steps. Step 8 is to list out all persons we did something wrong to. Step 9 is to actually make it right with them. So I went through it with my first sponsor and did the whole amends, wrote it out. But it became clear 2 or 3 years later that this person was still upset with me. So I brought it to my new sponsor. And I said that I'd already made amends. So he said, do you have it somewhere? And I actually did. I had done it on an app on my phone as well. So I had it written and I showed him what I wrote. And he said, I'm astonished that your last sponsor let you get away with this. He said, the whole thing is about you. He said, I want you to write a new amends to this person. And the word I does not exist in there. You went through this, and this is what it must have felt like, and this is how it must have affected you. And this, you know, put it through the other person, not I was going through a difficult time and therefore I did this. You were walking down the street and I decided that's maybe I could come there. And I decided to do this to you, and it must have affected you in this way. And I've no doubt it affected you in this way. And this is what I've done until now. And specifically, how can I make it right? So what you're saying dovetails well with that. We take the I out of it. It's like remove I everywhere. Realistically, right. When I say remove I everywhere, it's impossible to get every single I out. But in the first version, every sentence started with that.
When you've wronged somebody, when you've wronged somebody and you want to make it right, the person you've wronged doesn't have to hear that much about your guilt. Obviously, right. They should know that you don't feel good about what you've done. But be very careful not to elaborate too much on that, because it's not about you. It's about the person you're trying to appease. Right. It's about how they feel.
I've made this point to someone, and you know, we use the term living amends before, but we didn't elaborate on it. I've made the point to someone that I think it's in some ways more important than the direct amends. For example, let's say someone stole money from another person and came to them and said, I'm terribly sorry about it. I can't return the full amount. So I'm going to start paying you in installments. Version one. I think that person who went through it, yeah, he wants the money back, but as far as forgiveness, could reach 100% forgiveness. Okay, they did it. They're doing everything possible to restore it. Versus another one who came and said, I stole $100 from you. Here it is back. I'm terribly sorry about it. Here it is.
Can I have a receipt?
Correct. And the next week, you hear in Shul that he stole $100 from someone else.
Right.
So that person has been repaid 100%, but they won't feel good about it at all. Like, well, you felt bad. Yeah, you felt right. You felt bad. You got caught. So now you gave it back, but now you're doing it again. And that's the living amends. The living amends is I could never undo wrongs from my past, but I cannot do it again to anyone else.
Somebody told me the other day, I was in Brooklyn and I was trying to park. You know how hard it is to park in Brooklyn. Someone says to me, there's always a parking spot. Question is how much it costs.
Right.
So it's like unrepentantly parking in front of the fire hydrant and, you know, like, okay, so I'll pay the fine. So that's basically saying, you know, yeah, all right, I wronged you. You got to pay for it. I got caught, got to pay for it. But the guy's unrepentant. He didn't change his ways. Yeah. So that doesn't feel good.
Understood. Now let's talk about. Okay, so what's that? So now we're going back to the Rambam. We're obviously talking about. I know we state the obvious, but the obvious has to be stated.
This whole thing has
been obvious, I think, so far. But you know, yeah. we have to state the obvious. So when someone asks three times, and that person refuses to forgive, and assuming everything is done, so what happens then? Everything is done correctly. The restitution, it was made about the other person. The amends, the living amends, whatever. You know, or whatever. What was the word the Rambam used? Lirtzaisei?
Yeah, to appease him, to make him feel better, to comfort him. Lirtzaisei. Yeah. To make him, I mean, it's from the word Rotzwein, to make him feel good about the relationship again. Maybe he's not going to want to be your buddy again, but at least there's no emotional debt.
So when now this person doesn't forgive, the person who is wronged after all that doesn't forgive the other person, that's considered wrong?
Yeah.
That's a sin?
He actually says, yeah, that it flips. It's Uno reverse card. Yeah.
And is that a sin between man and man, or a sin between man and God?
It's a very interesting question, whether you pick up the man and man sin that the other guy now dumped on you, or if it's a new if it's a new sin. I don't know, but he says, I mean, he basically says that if the other guy doesn't want to forgive him, then v'zesh le'machol, the one who doesn't forgive, who hachaite? Now he's the sinner. Does it mean
what does
the same
it mean?
Sin? I don't know if the same sin then gets transferred over. I'm signing it over to you. Now it's your sin.
I guess theoretically speaking, it's a sin between man and God, because if this went over to the other person, then the first guy doesn't have anything anymore. So he didn't do anything wrong because he has nothing left on him. Right? After doing this three times, it's done.
Yeah. Although, should I add one more thing just for the sake of fun?
Go ahead.
Since we're learning a lot of Rambam here. He says there's an exception to that. He says, V'im hoyer rabbi, if it was his teacher. Then he says, Afilo elef pa'amim. You're supposed to go to him even 1,000 times. And I don't think he literally means limit it to 1,000 times. He means you just keep going until he forgives you.
If someone did something wrong to their teacher,
yeah,
then keep going. Maybe the teacher is trying to teach them a lesson.
Yeah, could be. Yeah.
Okay, so now in terms of, I've heard, I want to talk about the types of sins that could be forgiven as well from the vantage point of the offender. And I'm not talking about between man and man, because I think we've addressed that. Let's say between man and God. I've heard this concept, I don't know where it said, is that someone who is meister on someone else, someone who rats tattletales on someone else, or someone who charges interest, ribbis, to someone else. Those two categories of people are not returned by Tchias HaMeisim, right? When eventually, when Mashiach comes and Messiah comes, all lives are said to be reinstored. Those categories of people are not. Have you heard that? And I'm not looking to talk about as much about those sins as I am to talk about the concept. Are there certain wrongs that just are unforgivable? Those type of mistakes.
There's a lot of things. In Le'elam Haba, it says that someone who embarrasses somebody publicly has no portion in the world to come.
Presumably that can be forgiven, right? Between man and man. We've all embarrassed someone, I think.
Well, the examples you were giving also are interpersonal relationships.
Right. And within interpersonal relationships, I think we've addressed that someone can get forgiveness from the other person.
By the way, when you're talking about interest, maybe the guy who paid the interest was happy to do so. Maybe he doesn't consider himself a victim.
Maybe he doesn't, but it's still a sin to pay or collect interest.
Yeah.
Person who bought the opioids doesn't consider himself
a
victim either.
But that's right.
1 in 100 are dying. So, no, those are the numbers. But
so, what are you driving at here? What's
I want to know conceptually if there are sins that are unforgivable, meaning between man and man, I think we've addressed those. Someone does something wrong, you have to go through this process of retribution and restitution and all of those things. And assuming he made it right and the other person was okay with it, even if he shamed him in public, that could be forgiven. But then there are some sins that are, actually what you said about interest is perfect. If party A pays party B interest and both are perfectly happy with that transaction, and assuming no heter iska, no business allowance or anything else, just interest.
Again, stating the obvious. Yes.
Yes. It's a sin. Mm-hmm. If someone, let's stay with the interests example, because it's simpler and more obvious.
Okay.
What I've heard about this is that that person cannot, like by Tchias HaMeisim, they don't come back, which would be the same thing as they have no stake in Olam Haba, the future.
Right. World.
So that communicates the concept that there are certain sins, as far as God is concerned, that are unforgivable.
Okay.
And that's what I want to understand. Is that in fact the case? Are there certain sins that are unforgivable?
Well, let me ask you a question. What does unforgivable mean? Because
the slate can never be wiped completely clean.
Does it mean that if somebody dies without having done teshuva?
That we understand anyway. That
you're saying even the person did teshuva and he earnestly did everything he can to make good on it. So you're saying that nothing.
That's what I'm asking. Does that concept exist, or do we know with certainty that assuming someone goes through the right steps, whatever they are for each individual wrong, whether it's between man and person or man and God, that one can be completely forgiven in any and all cases? That's my question. Let's maybe use the word redemption.
So here's the deal.
And we'll end on this.
Nothing stands in the way of teshuva. Question is, how much teshuva is it going to require? But just like we're talking about coming to a person and not just saying in a perfunctory way that I'm sorry, but actually thinking about their feelings and trying to make them feel better, so to speak, you have to always say when you're talking about Hashem, so to speak, kevayachol, right? Because we don't want to humanize God. Although, let me just pause for 1 second and say something funny. I was speaking recently to a group of young people. It was in Manhattan. And I spoke about, it was right before Rosh Hashanah, I was speaking about going into Rosh Hashanah and telling Hashem that you want to be in a relationship with him. So this young woman comes over to me after the talk, and she's like, Hashem wants to be in a relationship with you? Come on, that's what Rosh Hashanah is? It sounds so human. So I'm like, okay, well, how do you think Rosh Hashanah is? She's like, well, you know, like, he's judging you, and if you wronged him, he's going to punish you for it, and he's not going to let you off the hook. I said, that also sounds human.
Even more human.
So in being this petty, vindictive God, that's not too human. That's godly, right? But being interested in a relationship with you and trying to do anything that it takes to save the relationship, no, that's too human. Okay.
She summed up what a lot of people were thinking. It's beautiful.
Yeah. So I wish she had said it in front of everybody.
Right.
But okay, at any rate, so just like when we go to a person, it's not just about, okay, how much did I steal from you? $100? Okay, write me a receipt. I gave you back $100. It's about the emotional aspect of it. So to teshuva, when you return to Hashem, it's about the emotional aspect. It's not just, okay, I sinned and I don't do that anymore. It's about how strongly I feel the need to restore the relationship. And in that, there are infinite levels because it's not quantifiable. When if you stole $100, it's very binary. Did you pay it back or didn't you? When it comes to the emotional component, it's endless, which is why tshuva is endless. So we know that when somebody does tshuva with all of their heart, not only it wipes the slate clean, but I'm sure you're familiar with the concept.
Like you said earlier, it's an even stronger relationship.
It's an even stronger relationship, right? That's right. That's right. Okay. So we can come back from anything.
Beautiful. So we can end on that. Yeah. May our brief words here help many people to restore even stronger relationships between themselves and between their creator.
Amen. That's a beautiful bracha going into Yom Kippur.
Have a wonderful and easy fast.
Yeah, you too. Okay, thank you. Okay, Gmar Sima Teva. All right. You too.